This lecture is brought to you by the virtual campus of the Reformed Baptist Seminary. For information on other courses or seminary programs, please contact us at virtual.seminary.org.
Well, in our lectures that wound up last Saturday, we were considering the doctrine of the late Middle Ages concerning man in his sin and his natural capacity. And you remember, more and more it tended in the direction of Pelagianism the further we got in the late Middle Ages, especially in Gabriel Biel, this idea that man just does the best that's in him, and according to a pactum, a covenant, God now is gracious and accepts those lesser works, and then he blesses those lesser works with congruent merit, and then after congruent grace, and what you do by congruent grace is congruent merit, and then based on that, then he will give condign merit, and then that is meritorious. And we saw in our last lecture that Luther was wedded to this kind of thinking early on, and we saw that he began to reject the nominalist conception of the sinner's preparation for grace later on, around 1516. And then around 1517, in his Heidelberg disputation, he came out with an open rejection of the nominalist position. And now we come, and this is page 113 in the notes, we come to consider Luther's doctrine in itself concerning man in sin and the extent of his sinfulness. We considered his general concept of sin on Saturday. Sin is robbery of God. Sin is robbery of our neighbor. But now, with respect to the extent of man's sinfulness, we want to look, first of all, at his general conception of the extent of man's sinfulness. And it is that fallen man is flesh. The characteristic term that he used to describe fallen man's depraved nature is flesh. And in Luther's use of this term, we hear distinct echoes of the Pauline use of the term. For Luther, as well as Paul, sarx is not equivalent to soma. Neither Luther nor Paul were thinking of man's body in distinction of his soul. That's not what he's speaking about when he speaks of flesh. When Luther speaks of man's flesh, he was not thinking of a constituent element of man's makeup as a creature of God, whether body or soul or some portion of the soul. His use of the term was not anthropological about man's makeup, but theological. And in this connection, the first point that we want to make is that in Luther's usage, flesh includes both corporeal and incorporeal aspects of our nature. Fallen man, body and soul, is flesh. Medieval scholasticism, under the sway of Hellenistic dualism, tended to equate flesh with man's physical being. In the theological parlance of the day, the fleshly man was governed by his physical appetites as opposed to the higher dictates of the spirit or of reason. Of course, when you go to the monastery, you try to mortify the flesh and get holy by the deeds of the body being subjugated. But Luther declares, everything outside of grace and the Spirit of Christ is flesh. Flesh doesn't denote a constituent element of man's makeup, but the entirety of his fallen condition. The whole man is flesh. Commenting on Galatians 3:3, having begun in the Spirit, are you now being made perfect by the flesh? Luther writes, from this passage it is clear that flesh is taken not only in the sense of sensuality or the lusts of the flesh, but in the sense of everything that is outside grace and the Spirit of Christ. Whatever, therefore, does not proceed from faith is flesh. On Paul's reference to sowing to one's flesh in Galatians 6:8, he notes, here again, flesh must not be understood as referring to lust alone. But in keeping with the apostle's way of thinking, it must, as the text itself compels, be understood as referring to all that is not spirit, that is, to the whole man. And again, he says, In my temerity, I do not make a complete separation of flesh, soul, and spirit. For the flesh experiences no desire except through the soul and spirit, by virtue of which it is alive. By spirit and flesh, moreover, I understand the whole man, especially the soul itself. So his use of flesh is to refer to the whole man and its depraved condition. But then B, instead of associating flesh either exclusively or chiefly with the physical passions, Luther says that man is flesh above all in his spirituality. You see, the medievals, they just said it's all in your body, in your desires of your body. Luther says it's especially in your soul. Above all, it is in man's spirituality, in his heart and soul, in his highest and most excellent powers. In that part of his being that is the capacity for religion, it is above all in this that he is flesh. When Erasmus seeks to magnify the capabilities of the spiritual part of the natural man, Luther argues that it is precisely in man's reason and will that his ignorance and contempt of religion and godliness lie. He says, ignorance and contempt are not seated in the flesh in the sense of the lower and grosser affections, but in the highest and most excellent powers of man, in which righteousness, godliness, and knowledge and reverence God should reign, that is, in reason and will. Now, Erasmus argued, not every energy in man is flesh. There is an energy called the soul, and the one called the spirit, by which we aspire to what is upright. And to prove these assertions, Erasmus pointed to the pagan philosophers, who taught that we should welcome 1,000 deaths sooner than commit a vile deed. And Luther's rejoinder is that even if we were to discover the highest example of pagan virtue, we could not see into his heart. Nevertheless, upon inspection, it is immediately apparent that their noblest works were done for their own glory, for they were even willing to boast that it was their own glory that they sought. And thus, Luther says, by the most ungodly robbery, they robbed God of his glory and took it to themselves, and were never less upright and more vile than when they shone in their highest virtues. Here you have your spirit that rules, your principal part of man, which aspires to that which is upright, a plunderer of God's glory and a usurper of his majesty. So you take the highest part of man's spiritual being and its highest actions apart from grace. It's still flesh. It's robbery of God. And it is in the spiritual part of man's being that sin exists in its most grotesque an abominable form. Man's self-righteousness, conceit, insolence, and unbelief are spiritual, yet they are the grossest manifestations of his nature as flesh. The best teaching and the best acts that men can produce, whether they be philosophers, orators, or even pontiffs, are of the flesh, since they do not teach faith. That is, since they do not promote that faith that rests in Christ alone and gives glory to God alone. And quoting Althaus, he says, Luther thus gives to the traditional concept of concupiscence a new meaning, corresponding to what it means in Paul's theology. Concupiscence is much more than sensuality lusting against reason as the higher part of man. Rather, it is the opposition of the entire man to God. This opposition is centered in man's soul and spirit. In all this, Luther is conscious of restoring the genuine meaning of Paul's concepts, which were so badly misinterpreted in the theology of the early and medieval church. So not only does he redefine flesh in terms of the medieval church, back to what Paul taught in terms of the flesh being the whole depraved man, body and soul. But he also redefines concupiscence, bringing it to apply to both aspects of man's character. And then, opening this up, see, only in the Christian are good and evil truly mixed. The tension of Romans 7, 14 to 25, Luther understands to be that of the Christian and not of the natural man in his fallen state. So the typical Reformed interpretation is what Luther's interpretation of Romans, the last half of Romans 7. It is only the Christian who can be described accurately as a man in contradiction. The natural man is completely flesh. This does not mean that every sinner is as bad as he could be, nor does it mean that there are no commendable impulses to be found in the heart of the natural man. Luther doesn't immediately abandon all Occam's formulations in this connection. There's a little bit of a progress here. Early on, he still talks about the role of synderesis, which is a natural human inclination for the good, or of scintilla animi, a spark of the soul. These were nominalist conceptions. You got this little spark of divinity in your soul that inclines toward God. You got this synderesis, this natural inclination to good. And it's that little tiny impulse for good that makes you do the deed at least outwardly in accord with God's law. And you do the best you can. And you nurture that, and then God gives you grace. That was the whole idea. And Luther, early on, he still has a little bit of that in his system. He speaks of synderesis and scintilla animi. It's possible that his esteem for the mystical writings of Tauler, whose use of these terms seems to be something of a carryover from the mysticism of Eckhart, that this also influenced Luther. But the old Occamist wineskins are filled with new Luther vintage. Synderesis functions very much for Luther as the sense of divinity does for John Calvin. We'll see what this is when we get to the theology of Calvin. And just in the footnotes, you'll notice in footnote 4 that in his lectures on Romans, he refers to the practical syllogism by which the pagans have a knowledge of God. And in scholastic theology, the major premises of this practical syllogism was synderesis. The man has synderesis, and then the sense of God, and then based on this, then he has a knowledge of God. And so he uses this, but it's a little bit of a different wrinkle. It's more like a sense of divinity. And the two expressions are not identical, for synderesis is a moral term describing the inclination to good, and the sense of divinity is a religious expression describing a consciousness of the divine. Referring to Calvin there, his sense of divinity. But the function of both is similar. Luther uses the synderesis in a similar way, I'm saying, to Calvin. However, the big question for Luther is not the presence or absence of such a spark of the soul in man, but what that spark is able to produce. In a section in which he's exposing the inadequacies of the nominalist conceptions of man's sin nature, Luther responds to the assertion that since the will has this synteresis, and you'll see it spelled different ways, sometimes with a T, sometimes with a D. Since this will has this synteresis, he says, it is inclined, albeit weakly, toward the good. And this minute motion towards God, which man can perform by nature, they imagine to be an act of loving God above all things. Remember, they could say that you could even, this is Gabriel Biel, you could even get to the point where a natural man even, he can love God supremely. Yes, in fallen man, there may on occasions be, as Luther puts it, a very tiny motion toward the good. But look at man as he actually is, and see how his whole person is full of these sinful desires, and how that little motion has no effect at all. And so as David Steinmetz explains, synderesis, so far from providing an anthropological resource for the return of the sinner to God, actually intensifies the sinner's predicament and increases his guilt. Because human reason is blind and the human will is deformed, synderesis, which is hailed by Luther at first as a residuum of health in the soul, is a mark of what Paul Tillich called unhealthy health. An apparent health, which is only a symptom of a far more serious disease. And thus, for all of his vaunted power, Sundarasis neither lessens man's guilt nor brings him any closer to God. Luther points out that willy-nilly the theologians recognize their own evil lusts, and yet they are so eager to champion the natural powers of the flesh. And at this, he can't restrain himself from taunting the folly of such reasoning. He says, "For this reason I say, ha, get busy now, I beg you. Be men, work with all your might, so that these lusts may no longer be in you." In other words, get busy doing the best that you could do. Prove that it is possible by nature to love God, as you say, with all your strength and without any grace. If you were without concupiscence, we will believe you. So in other words, Sundarasis or no Sundarasis, where it all comes right down to it, flesh is still flesh. And it's only in the Christian that there's truly evil and good mixed in his soul, conflict between the two in that sense. Well, his general conception then of man's natural condition is this term flesh. But now we want to come to his particular conception of the extent of man's sinfulness. Man's will is bound. And we're going to spend more time on this concept. Luther's great treatise, The Bondage of the Will, was written in 1525, 4 years after the Diet of Worms. From 1521, from that date on, increasing pressure. So after the Diet of Worms, increasing pressure was being brought to bear on Erasmus to declare himself against Luther. In a dispatch to Rome dated February 8, 1521, the papal legate Aleander, he calls Erasmus the great cornerstone of the Lutheran heresy. Now you can see, did you have a chance to read the little section on Erasmus? That's in the introductory notes. I don't know if you got that far. But there are points early on where it seems like he's on Luther's side. He's just blasting the Pope, he's blasting the monks, he's blasting the friars, he's blasting everything in the Catholic Church for its scandal, its ungodliness, and so forth. And so they were beginning to think, well, he's on the side of the reformers. And so this statement is made by Aleander, that Erasmus is the great cornerstone of the Lutheran heresy. And during the same year, Leo X died as Pope Leo. And Adrian, a friend of Erasmus, invited him to come to Rome where he might have the leisure to write against Luther. So they're saying, you look like you're on his side. You need to write something against him. In the following years, many others, including the King of England, urged him to pick up his mighty pen and address what many saw to be a growing menace to the church. You see, you got all these mighty potentates beginning to put pressure on Erasmus. Erasmus was so powerful with his writer. His satire, it makes you fall off your chair with laughter sometimes as he exposes things. And sometimes that can, it doesn't lead anybody to the truth, but sometimes it can expose error. And so they wanted this guy, now he had used his powers against the church, now to use them against Luther. And among those things that irritated Erasmus about Luther were his riddles and paradoxes, and especially those places in his writings where he called free will an empty word. So they want him to write against Luther. And so he begins to think, well, what is there in Luther that I don't like? And it's this stuff about free will, not being free will, really, that I don't really like that. And therefore, in 1524, he did come out against Luther. And when he did so, it was with a work that he entitled Diatribe Sciocolatio de Libero Arbitrio, a diatribe or a discourse concerning free will. And it's usually simply referred to just as his diatribe. And the Pope, and by the way, back then a diatribe didn't didn't have the same negative connotations that we would associate with it today. And the Pope, the Emperor, and Henry VIII welcomed it openly. Well, the great reformer's reply did not come at once. Among other things, he was preoccupied with writing against the heavenly prophets, a group of fanatical extremists. And also he was responding to the peasants' revolt, an awful calamity that came upon Germany. And the peasants, they began to take his statements, the addressing people about their freedom and so forth. They took it to extremes. And it was also during this time that he was married. And his dear Katie knew very well how to get his attention. If you ever want some delightful reading, read that little book, Luther and His Katie. It's just, she's a wonderful woman. And it's very obvious that that sometimes she knew how to play the heartstrings of Luther. And so anyway, you can see how he'd be a little distracted getting married to her. But in December of 1525, Luther's response finally made its appearance. And it was roughly four times the length of Erasmus's diatribe. And then after that, Erasmus replied with two lengthy tomes, the Hyperaspistes, in which were bitter in tone and intricate in presentation. And to these treatises, Luther did not respond. Well, Luther's Bondage of the Will is widely recognized as the greatest piece of theological writing that he ever produced. And we might say his greatest exegetical production was Commentary on Galatians, or Lectures on Galatians. But this is his greatest theological writing. And this was also his own opinion. In a letter to Capito on July 9th, 1537, referring to a suggested complete edition of his works, he plainly asserted that none of them deserve preservation, except his Children's Catechism and the Bondage of the Will, for only they, he says, were right. After endorsing a description of it as a dialectic and polemical masterpiece, B.B. Warfield styled the Bondage of the Will the embodiment of Luther's Reformation conceptions, the nearest thing to a systematic statement of them that he ever made, and in a true sense, the manifesto of the Reformation. In an excellent introduction to this work, Packer and Johnston state, and if you want to, if you don't have a copy of Luther's Bondage of the Will, get the one Revel is the printer, but it's got that, it's a very helpful introduction by Packer and Johnston. And in that introduction, they state that in its fertility of thought, its vigor of language, its profound theological grasp, its sustained strength of argument, and the grand sweep of its exposition, it stands unsurpassed among Luther's writings. Now, the contrast between this work and the diatribe of Erasmus could not be more striking. The diatribe is elegantly and gracefully written, but devoid of true insight. In Gordon Rupp's estimation, he is shrewd, and in comparison with Luther, almost urbane. I think one may say from Luther's point of view, maddeningly and provocatively calm. But he points carefully the deadly poisoned barb, all referring to Erasmus's diatribe. And yet it is evident that its author had no deep interest in his subject. He just wishes to dismiss Luther's pesky doctrine as an irritating fly that deserves a quick swat. And he does so in a brief, superficial manner. The book makes it plain that Erasmus is no true theologian. He seeks to make the point that this matter over which Luther has been making such a fuss is not really a very significant issue at all. Luther's gone way overboard in stressing an opinion which is extreme and is only supported by a few, and all of this concerning an obscure, doubtful matter. Remember his emphasis. If you read the section that I wrote about Erasmus, he emphasized the philosophy of Christ, that Christ His teaching is essentially like the philosophers, and he's a moralist. That's basically what we need. And that when it all boils down to it, Christianity is very simple. Basically, Christianity says be good. Be like Jesus. And don't get got all up in all these theological intricacies. And he was rebelling against the scholastic tendency to get so intricate in theology. And so when he responds to Luther, it's in somewhat of a similar manner. Luther, on the other hand, saw the matter at hand as being at the very heart of the gospel. It's not just a little insignificant issue. As he was bringing the work to a conclusion, he commends Erasmus for his learning and eloquence, and then thanks him for writing his diatribe. "You alone, in contrast with all others, have attacked the real thing, that is, the essential issue. You have not wearied me with those extraneous issues about the papacy, purgatory, indulgences, and such like, trifles rather than issues, in respect of which almost all to date have sought my blood, though without success. You, and you alone, have seen the hinge on which all turns, and aimed for the vital spot. For that I heartily thank you, for it is more gratifying to me to deal with this issue, insofar as time and leisure permit me to do so." Now, free will, it was no mere academic interest to Luther. It was the pivotal point on which the whole gospel of the grace of God rested. The gospel rose or fell depending on which way this doctrine was interpreted. Luther was convinced that he was going to battle over the gospel itself. In his mind, it's no credit to the theologian to pretend to be unconcerned or uncommitted when the truth of the gospel is at stake. And it is this that explains the intensity and vigor of Luther's language in this treatise. He gets hot sometimes, just like Paul does in Galatians 1. Packer and Johnston bring us back to the scene as it was in 1525. The gospel of God is in jeopardy. The springs of Luther's religion are touched. The man is moved. The volcano erupts. Argument pours out of him, white hot. Now, the divergent attitudes of these two men regarding the issue at hand sprang from two radically different conceptions of Christianity. According to Erasmus, doctrinal matters are relatively unimportant. Christianity is essentially simple moral philosophy taught by Christ. What one believes about the mysteries of the faith makes no little practical difference. And whatever the church teaches, just believe it and quit making such a fuss. And of all things, don't disrupt Christendom over obscure doctrinal matters. But to Luther, Christianity is a matter of doctrine first and foremost. And so he takes Erasmus to task for his cool indifference. He says, to start with, "I observe that, as elsewhere, you censure me for being overbold and making assertions. So here in this book, you say that you find so little satisfaction in assertions that you would readily take up the skeptic's position wherever the inviolable authority of Holy Scripture and the Church's decisions permit. Though you gladly submit your judgment to these authorities and all that they lay down, whether you follow it or not." In other words, you're saying, "I don't want to quarrel about these issues. I'll just believe what the church says. I don't know about it, but I'll just submit." Well, that is the outlook that appeals to you. To take no pleasure in assertions is not the mark of a Christian heart. Indeed, one must delight in assertions to be a Christian at all. Away now with skeptics and academics from the company of us Christians. Let us have men who will assert. Take the Apostle Paul. How often does he call for that full assurance, which is simply an assertion of conscience, of the highest degree of certainty and conviction. In Romans 10, he calls it confession with the mouth. Confession is made unto salvation. Christ says, "Whosoever confesses me before men, him I will confess before my Father." What Christian can endure the idea that we should depreciate assertions? That would be denying all religion and piety in one breath, asserting that religion and piety and all dogmas are just nothing at all. Well, at the bottom of the whole debate was the biblical doctrine of grace. So this is at the bottom of this whole issue of free will. It is whether or not the sinner would be brought to cast himself upon Christ alone. And the man who hasn't embraced this doctrine never really comprehended the rest of the gospel. And this is going to be more and more apparent as we now take up some of the basic points that Luther makes in this great work. So now we come to some of the materials that have just been added this week. And what we want to now do is just kind of summarize what Luther says in his treatise, The Bondage of the Will. A, the meaning of free will and the bondage of the wills. So he begins by defining his terms. The primary disagreement between Luther and Erasmus was not over the reality of human choice, whether there is such a thing as people making choices. The main issue over which they sparred was not about man's psychological makeup. Granted, Erasmus didn't see this as well as Luther. He spoke of Luther's determinism as if it involved psychological compulsion. But Luther's denial of free will was not a denial of the spontaneity of human choices. He wasn't saying that we're automatons, that we're robots. But rather, it was with respect to man's obedience to God and his faith in Christ. It's ethical, moral, spiritual in nature, this bondage. Do we have the ability to obey God? Do we have the ability to believe in Christ? The free will that he denied was in relation to God. Erasmus had defined free will as a power of the human will by which a man can apply himself to those things that lead to eternal salvation or turn away from the same. The sense in which is very similar to the nominalist. You can just do the best you can. Free will gives you that power. Now, in response, Luther asserted, and first of all, summarizing his thought, he emphasized first that free will belongs to God alone. In a limited sense, free will belongs to man as he functions as a vice regent over things below. But in the ultimate sense, only God is free will. He says, I showed above that free will belongs to none but God only. You are no doubt right in assigning to man a will of some sort. But to credit him with a will that is free in the things of God is too much. For all who hear mention of free will, take it to mean, in its proper sense, a will that can and does do Godward all that it pleases, restrained by no law and no command. For you would not call a slave who acts at the beck of his Lord free. But in that case, how much less are we right if we call men or angels free? For they live under the complete mastery of God, not to mention sin and death, and cannot continue by their own strength for a moment. Our question is this, whether man has free will Godward, that God should obey man and do what man wills, or whether God has not rather a free will with respect to man, that man should will and do as a God wills, or as God wills, and be able to do nothing about what he wills and he does. Should capitalize God there in that quote there at the end. And so, in defining the terms here, he says free will ultimately belongs only to God. But also he says in defining the terms that man through sin has not ceased to be man, but he has ceased to be good. That's the issue. It's not whether you have actual freedom, you know, there's true volitional spontaneous choices as man's makeup, but it's an ethical, moral issue. In his fallen state, man is unable to please God or to do anything but continue in sin. And in this, we see God's sentence on fallen humanity. Man is no longer able to turn to God. Erasmus had insisted that even after the fall, a little of man's former ability had been preserved. If only a little grace were added to man's natural capabilities, man would turn to God. But Luther stood firm. Fallen man is incapable of even the slightest inclination toward God. He says, "You describe the power of free will as small and wholly ineffective apart from the grace of God." Agreed? Now then, I ask you, if God's grace is found wanting, if it is taken away from that small power, what can it do? It is ineffective, you say, and can do almost nothing good. So it will not do what God or His grace wills. Why? Because we have now taken God's grace away from it, and what the grace of God does not do is not good. Hence it follows that, quote, free will, unquote, without God's grace is not free at all, but it is the permanent prisoner and bond slave of evil, since it cannot turn itself to good. This being so, I give you full permission to enlarge the power of free will as much as you like. Make it angelic, make it divine if you can. But when once you add this doleful postscript, that it is ineffective apart from God's grace, straightway you rob it of all of its power. What is ineffective power but in plain language, no power? So to say that free will exists and has power, albeit ineffective power, is in the sophist phrase a contradiction in terms. It is like saying free will is something which is not free, as if you said that fire is cold and earth hot. Well, to sum up, the bondage of the will is a moral inability to do good or turn to the good. And if man is unable to contribute even the least of ways toward his own salvation, his salvation must be wholly of grace. And still, as we are trying to define this whole issue of what free will is and the bondage of the will, another point that needs to be made is that though man has lost his ability to do good, he is still responsible to do good. A man is not forced to sin against his own will, but rather, in his will, he finds an inescapable compulsion to do evil. While he is necessarily a sinner, he is also voluntarily a sinner. We do not sin against our will, but rather according to our will. Now, concerning his own paradoxical statement, all we do is done not by free will, but of mere necessity, Luther says this: "I said of necessity, I did not say of compulsion. That is to say, a man without the Spirit of God does not do evil against his will, under pressure, as though he was taken by the scruff of the neck and dragged into it, like a thief or footpad being dragged off against his will to punishment. But he does it spontaneously and voluntarily. And this willingness or volition is something which he cannot in his own strength eliminate, restrain, or alter. He goes on willingly and desiring to do evil, to do the evil. And if external pressure forces him to act otherwise, nevertheless his will remains averse to so doing and chafes under such constraint and opposition." So what he's saying is that the sinner's will is bound, yet it remains his will, and he acts according to the dictates of his own depraved inclinations. So Luther spends time defining his terms in these ways. But now we come to, in his response, he gives an expose of semi-Pelagianism, which is what he attributes to Erasmus. And also it would be to scholastics and so forth. Well, the humanist Erasmus, as well as the scholastic traditionalist, admitted that the fall had weakened man, but denied that it had made him utterly incapable of meritorious action. Erasmus, his definition of free will, included the power of the human will by which a man may apply himself to those things that lead to eternal salvation. So, even though Luther was responding to Erasmus, the very real sense in which he was responding to these late nominalists, because they were, Erasmus had obviously inherited some of their thinking as well. There was a lot of parallel. This whole idea that you can begin things, you get the ball rolling, you apply yourself to meritorious action, to those things that lead to salvation. And admittedly, this ability was only a little power. It needs grace to assist and perfect it. But free will gets the ball rolling. Now, Erasmus's theory echoes the scholastic distinction between congruent merit and condign merit. In order that he might attain to the former, that is to congruent merit, man does everything in his power to apply himself to spiritual concerns and prepare himself for the reception of God's grace. This doesn't oblige God to give this grace, but it only removes the barrier to this grace, man's unworthiness, his unpreparedness. Remember that illustration of opening the shutters, the window. You remove the obstacles for God's grace. This is what you do by way of preparation for grace. And this preparation makes man a fit subject for the gift then of congruent grace, by which God works congruently or alongside the will of the sinner to produce in him those dispositions and actions that then make him a fit subject for the gift of justification. While the merit associated with the sinner's preparatory efforts is not commensurate with the boon of justification, because these preparatory efforts remove the barriers for the bestowal of justification, they make it congruous for God to bestow the grace of that justification. And, of course, justification is assumed not as we think of justification. We're thinking about basically changing our hearts within. And part of it involves this congruent grace, God giving us, he works alongside us congruently and helping us along. And the merit then associated with this congruent grace is congruent merit. Now when this congruent grace is given, the recipient is now capable of doing works formerly out of reach. Condign or worthy works, which God then is bound as a matter of justice to reward, works which may be properly looked upon as possessing condign merit. And we said all of this last Saturday, but I thought it would be helpful to just kind of summarize it all again here, to remind ourselves afresh of the basic structures of thought. And thus it was thought both God's freedom in giving salvation, as well as the reality of man's labors in earning that favor, is preserved. Now, how does Luther respond to this whole theory? First of all, he says the distinction is purely verbal. Whatever names are given to merit, whatever distinctions are applied, you're talking about congruent merit or condign merit, you're saying, well, we wouldn't say that right from the start he can do condign meritorious acts that God is bound to reward. Whatever distinctions you give, it amounts to the same thing. Man performs some action for which he, as an independent agent, seeks a reward from God. Salvation is merely God's response to what man has done. It all boils down to this: man saves himself. Semi-Pelagianism is Pelagianism at bottom. So he says, perhaps they will here say that they assign to free will as little as possible, not by any means condign merit. But these are empty words. For what is being sought by means of free will is that merit may have its place. Granted that your friends assign to free will as little as possible, nonetheless they teach us that by that little we can attain righteousness and grace. And they solve the problem as to why God justifies one and abandons another simply by presupposing free will and saying the one endeavored and the other did not. And God regards the one for his endeavor and despises the other. And he would be unjust if he were to do anything else. Though in what they say and write they profess that they do not attain grace or condign merit, we call the merit in question condign. They are only trying to fool us with a word, for they hold this thing nonetheless. What can excuse their not calling it condign merit when they assign to it all that pertains to condign merit, saying that he who endeavors finds grace in the sight of God, whereas he who does not endeavor does not find it? Is this not clearly a description of condign merit? Do they not make God a respecter of works, merits, and persons when they say that one man is without grace by his own fault because he did not endeavor, whereas another, because he endeavors, obtains grace, which he would not have obtained if he had not endeavored? If this is not condign merit, I should like to be told what condign merit is said to be. So this whole distinction is just purely verbal. Second response to the issue of semi-Pelagianism. In the end, semi-Pelagianism is worse than Pelagianism. Erasmus thought that by stressing the smallness of the power that man can exercise, that the jagged edges of his Pelagian principles would be smoothed away. But Luther says the opposite takes place. Erasmus has only cheapened his Pelagianism by reducing the price of salvation. And there's a similarity the way he argues here to the way he argues against indulgences. One of the things that so upset him about indulgences was that Tetzel and these sellers of indulgence were cheapening salvation. They were saying that you can buy your salvation now for a cheap price. You could just pay a little money. You don't have to repent and get really change your life. And that really upset Luther, that it cheapened salvation. And so this is the way he responds to Erasmus. He's cheapening his Pelagianism. He says, in their zeal to disagree with the Pelagians, they start denying condign merit. And by the very form of their denial, they set it up more fully. By word and pen, they deny it, but really in their hearts, they establish it and are worse than the Pelagians upon two accounts. In the first place, the Pelagians confess and assert condign merit straightforwardly, candidly, and honestly, calling a spade, and teaching what they really hold. But our friends here who hold and teach the same view try to fool us with lying words and false appearances, giving out that they disagree with the Pelagians when there is nothing that they are further from doing. If you regard our pretenses, we appear as the Pelagians' bitterest foes. He's quoting them, so to speak. But if you regard the facts in our hearts, we are Pelagians double-dyed. And then in the second place, second response to their claim to deny condign merit and Pelagianism. In the second place, this hypocrisy of theirs results in their valuing and seeking to purchase the grace of God at a much cheaper rate than the Pelagians. The latter assert that it is not by a feeble something within us that we obtain grace, but by the efforts and works that are complete, entire, perfect, many, and mighty. But our friends here tell us that it is by something very small, almost nothing, that we merit grace. Now, Pelagius, it's astounding when you read what he actually wrote in the works of Pelagius. He actually taught that somebody utterly without grace could be perfect. That's how much he had ascribed to free will. But Luther says, at least that Pelagianism asked for something. It had a morally high standard. You could come to this standard and therefore be accepted by God. But you've lowered a standard. You can merit grace by just doing a little. And the watered-down Pelagianism of Erasmus, as well as the nominalists and scholastics, we might say, it does not, as Luther points out, deserve any credit for being closer to the Augustinian position. But rather, it displays its audacity not only in advancing an unwarrantably high opinion of the natural powers of man, but also a shockingly low opinion of the ethical demands of God's kingdom. The semi-Pelagian compromise, says Warfield, while remaining Pelagian in principle, yet loses the high ethical position of Pelagianism. Seeking some middle place between grace and works, and fondly congratulating itself that it retains both, it merely falls between the stools and retains neither. It depends as truly as Pelagianism on works, but reduces those works on which it nevertheless depends to a vanishing point. And so, and here to quote Packer and Johnston, pure plagiarism is bad enough, for it tells us that we are able to earn our salvation, and that is to flatter man. But semi-Pelagianism is worse, for it tells us that we need hardly do anything to earn our salvation. And this is to belittle salvation and to insult God. And then Luther's third overall argument is that Pelagianism of any kind, whether semi or full-blown, is indefensible. Two considerations knock the legs out from under the system. First place, fallen man can only sin. The scriptures tell us that man is not only bound, but also blind. Take, for instance, John, who is an eloquent and powerful scourge of free will. Should be the word "and" instead of "and." And so, referring to the Gospel of John, right at the outset, Luther says he assigns to free will such blindness that it does not even see the light of truth. So far is it from being able to strive after it. He says the light shines in darkness, but the darkness comprehended it not. John 1:5. The scriptures also make it plain that apart from God's grace, man is under the universal dominion and guilt of sin. Romans 3:9 declares that Jews and Gentiles are all under sin. And by saying all, he accepts none. By describing them as all under sin, that is, slaves of sin, he leaves them no goodness. Where are any who deliver themselves by the power of their own free will? Who can find a loophole in the all of this text? All are under sin, Jews and Gentiles. Where's the loophole? This text doesn't stand alone, for Paul uses such universal terms in many other places. And here he says, speaking for myself, I am a sinner. And by the way, he goes through all kinds of these passages one by one. But here, coming now to kind of a summary, he says, speaking for myself, I am astounded that when Paul so often uses these comprehensive terms, all, none, not, never, without, as in they are all gone out of the way. There is none righteous, none that does good, no, not one. All are sinners condemned by the offense of the one. We are justified by faith without the law and without works, so that he who would alter Paul's language could not thereby increase the clarity and plainness of his speech. I am amazed, I repeat, how it has happened that in the face of these comprehensive terms and statements, others that are contrary, yes, contradictory to them, should have won acceptance, such as some are not gone out of the way, and are not unrighteous, are not evil, and are not sinners, and not condemned. And there is nothing in man that is good and strives after good. As though he who strives after good, whoever he may be, is not covered by the terms all, none, and not. Personally, I could find nothing, even if I wished to advance and reply against Paul, but would be forced to include the power of my own free will and its endeavors with it among the all and the none of which Paul speaks, unless we are to introduce a new grammar and a new mode of speech. Had Paul used such an expression once or in one place only, it might have been permissible to suspect a figure of speech and to isolate and strain the words. But as it is, he uses such expressions constantly in both affirmative and negative sentences, and everywhere expresses his views by categorical statement and comprehensive contrast. So fallen man can only sin. The alls, the nevers, and so on of Paul especially emphasize this. But then, as he says that Pelagianism of any kind is indefensible, the second place, do we have time to wrap this up still in this?
Yes, I think we stop at this next point.
Okay, all right. The idea, his second argument against it is the idea of a meritorious act carries with it the idea of an independent act performed by man apart from God. But there is no such thing. God is sovereign over all. Man cannot act independently of God. He can never put God in debt to him. And to think in such terms is to ascribe divinity. In this respect, absolute independence is divinity. And to ascribe that to free will. Luther even charges Erasmus with a form of deism. Deism is that God has kind of wound up the clock and then let it run, and he just kind of keeps his hand off the world. He says, you, and by the way, deism came after the 1500s, so we're just saying he ascribes that kind of a concept to Erasmus. You who imagine that the human will is something placed in an intermediate position of freedom and left it to itself, find it easy to imagine that there is at the same time an endeavoring of the will in either direction. For you imagine that both God and the devil are far away, mere spectators, as it were, of this mutable free will. You do not believe that they are the prompters and drivers of an enslaved will, and each waging relentless war against the other. Well, in opposition to this notion of an autonomous free will in a world with an absentee God and an absentee devil, Luther, he borrows an illustration, it seems, that was used by Augustine. Man's will is like a beast standing between two riders. If God rides, it wills and goes where God wills. As the psalm says, I am become as a beast before thee, and am ever with thee. If Satan rides, it wills and goes where Satan wills. Nor may it choose to which rider it will run, or which it will seek. But the riders themselves fight to decide who shall have and hold it. Now, if man could choose his own rider, he would be free, even sovereign, in his own salvation. But as a sinner, he is a slave in the devil's kingdom. The devil's riding him. He's the devil's slave. He cannot escape. Only God can deliver him. It's all up to him, that is, God. And then his final refutation of Pelagianism, semi-Pelagianism, is that the basic issue is works versus grace. The whole debate boils down to two opposing systems of soteriology, a works-based versus a grace-oriented system of salvation. Erasmus affirms that God's grace is earned by works. Luther, that our salvation is received by faith, freely and graciously given to those who are without merit of any kind. Erasmus thinks of merit soliciting the implantation of internal grace, which in turn then merits a reward. In his Ordo Salutis, Erasmus's Ordo Salutis, the will of the sinner turns to God, step number one. And all it does is all of its own accord. And step number two, it's strengthened to help it respond in ways that are even more pleasing to God, so that it then merits the reward of eternal life. But Luther asserts that nothing will ever meet the needs of desperate sinners but a divine intervention involving the total renewal of an utter corrupt humanity. And now to quote what he says, and we'll conclude this lecture with this quote. And I didn't have time. I was getting too tired to type in his quote. I'll just read it to you. Did you get this copy of this quote here? Did you print that out as well?
Yes.
Okay, all right. It's page 301 under Roman numeral 9 there. He says, add to this the instance quoted in the 10th chapter of Romans from Isaiah. I was found of them that sought me not. I manifested myself to them that asked not after me. Isaiah 65:1. Paul says this of the Gentiles, that it was given to them to hear and know Christ, when previously they could not even think of him, much less seek him or prepare themselves for him by the power of free will. From this instance, it is clear enough that grace comes so freely that no thought of it and certainly no endeavor or desire after it precedes its coming. And take the case of Paul. When he was Saul, what did he do with all the powers of his free will? Certainly, if his state of mind be regarded, his heart was set on what was best and highest. But look at the endeavor whereby he found grace. Not only did he not seek grace, but received it through his own mad fury against it. Of the Jews, on the other hand, Paul says in chapter 9, the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained unto the righteousness which is by faith. But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, has not attained unto the law of righteousness. What word then can any defender of free will breathe against this? The Gentiles, when filled with ungodliness and every vice, received righteousness freely by the mercy of God. And the Jews, who follow after righteousness with the greatest effort and endeavor, do so in vain. Is not this just to say that the endeavors of free will after the highest are vain, and that by them it rather grows worse and is carried away backwards? None can say that the Jews' efforts were not made with the highest power of free will. Paul himself bears record of them in the 10th chapter, that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. So nothing that is assigned to free will is lacking of the Jews. Yet nothing resulted, indeed the reverse of what they sought resulted. In the Gentiles, nothing that is assigned to free will was present. Yet for them, the righteousness of God resulted. What is this but positive proof by the very clear example of the two nations, the very plainest testimony of Paul, that grace was given freely to the undeserving and utterly unworthy, and is not attained by any of the efforts, endeavors, or works, small or great, or even the best and most uprighteous men who seek and follow after the righteousness, or after righteousness with flaming zeal. So, it comes right down to it. When you ascribe free will of being the thing that is the hinge on which salvation depends, choosing Christ, you're ascribing. You're coming up at that point with a doctrine of salvation by works, not by grace. Well, we're dismissed.